the administration's trying to figure out how they dig out of that hole, and then the next day there's another hole they're digging.
Alaska's senators are worried about reports that President Trump shared classified information with the Russians. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 16th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, with just one day left in the session, lawmakers confirm dozens of Governor Walker's appointments, but not without discussion.
He should not be advocating for additional jurisdiction from his position.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Early Honors Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers an experiential, individualized, and transformational education to high school seniors across Alaska. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Both of Alaska's U.S. senators say they're concerned by reports that President Trump shared classified intelligence with top Russian officials in the Oval Office. Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Senator Dan Sullivan says the White House needs more discipline. He says it would help if the president stops the morning tweets and focuses on the goals that got him elected.
I mean, when there's a lack of discipline in the White House, it's hard to get to those things which are important.
Sullivan says the White House staff needs a more disciplined process, too. Senator Lisa Murkowski says every day seems to bring new stories about the White House that raise serious questions.
You know, the administration's trying to figure out how they dig out of that hole, and then the next day there's another hole they're digging.
Both senators say they need more information about the president's conversation with the Russians and also about his firing of FBI Director James Comey last week. Murkowski says a special prosecutor may be warranted for the investigation that began with Russia's meddling in the election, though she says she still trusts the Senate Intelligence Committee is pursuing the facts without bias.
But if people don't believe that it has been fair and open and transparent, then maybe we haven't accomplished what we need to accomplish.
Sullivan says he places a lot of trust in National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. McMaster says the president's discussions with the Russians were wholly appropriate. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Sullivan also spoke on Talk of Alaska this morning about a broad range of topics, from national news stories to regional issues. Discussing the president's firing of FBI Director James Comey less than a week ago, Sullivan said nobody disputes the legality of the dismissal, but he said the timing of the firing raises serious questions.
When there are different explanations on an important topic like the firing of the FBI director, it undermines credibility, and that doesn't help the White House, doesn't help their ability to move important legislation forward with the Congress. And, you know, I think it even undermines some of our ability to get important national security and foreign policy goals accomplished.
But Sullivan stopped short of recommending any new course of action for the ongoing investigations into Russian involvement with the Trump campaign. On military matters, Sullivan defended his record as a strong advocate for the armed forces in Alaska. He pointed to a reversal of a 2015 decision by the Army to reduce the size of an airborne brigade in Anchorage. He also highlighted continued progress toward bringing two squadrons of new F-35 fighter jets to Eielson Air Force Base during the next few years, and with them, hundreds of millions in new federal construction dollars. The senator fielded questions on specific regional issues, including recent executive orders lifting environmental protections in the waters off Alaska's coast. One caller from Fairbanks asked Sullivan whether he supports the decision to allow the proposed Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay to move forward.
The ability to actually move forward, which is our law, both state and federal, to move forward to go through permitting is it needs to be rigorous, and they have the standard to meet. But I don't think a federal agency should just preemptively say no to that.
You can find the full hour-long recording of today's broadcast on our website, alaskapublic.org. 14 people have been the victims of homicide in Alaska's most populous city so far in 2017. That's four more than at this time last year. In 2016, the city made a new record with 34 homicides total. The annual national average for a city the size of Anchorage is about 16 homicides. Anchorage reached 14 homicides with the alleged murder of a 92-year-old woman by her 91-year-old husband on Sunday. The 2017 homicides include the three deaths in the alleged arson that burned the Royal Suite Lodge apartments in February. With the end of the legislative session looming, Alaska's Senate passed its version of an oil tax credit reform bill yesterday. But the Senate's version of House Bill 111 doesn't have much in common with the bill that the House passed a month ago. Both bodies agree that the state needs to stop paying cash for oil credits. It's a system that will leave the state owing nearly $700 million to oil companies by the end of the year. Now, the bill will head back to the House to see if its members will accept the Senate's changes. Technically, the session ends on Wednesday, and while lawmakers could vote to extend it by 10 days, it will take two-thirds of the members from both bodies to vote to do so. Governor Bill Walker could call legislators into a special session to resolve this issue. Walker spokesperson Grace Jang says it's too soon to say if he will. The legislature approved Governor Bill Walker's appointment of Hollis French to serve on the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission today. French, a former lawmaker himself, was confirmed by a 35-24 vote. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says he couldn't imagine a more qualified commissioner, noting French has been an acting commissioner for months.
He served with honesty for much of the past year, and he served with perhaps more experience than any public member who's ever been appointed to the recommended for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon voted against French's appointment. She says French wrongly tried to get the commission jurisdiction over a recent gas leak in Cook Inlet.
He should not be advocating for additional jurisdiction from his position. He should bring a concern to the Department of Law and let the administration move forward if they believe through the legislative process that there should be additional responsibilities given to AOGCC.
McKinnon also says French wrongly claimed that energy companies Hillcorp and Armstrong endorsed his appointment. The legislature approved 97 other Walker appointments, including Attorney General Jonna Lindemuth. Several appointments hadn't been voted upon by late afternoon, including Human Rights Commission member Drew Phoenix. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, thawing ice makes studying polar bears harder.
We're just going to have to try and figure out ways to work around this because I don't see it getting any better.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
After a years-long legal skirmish with state officials, Alaska's first marijuana club, Potluck Events, has closed its doors. From the beginning, there were disputes over the club's legality. The final straw was a cease and desist order from the state regulators and the passing of the club's founder, just days apart. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the closure comes while the state is still considering rules about where it's legal to consume cannabis beyond private property.
Good night, Potluck!
Inside a sprawling, dimly lit room with high ceilings, a few guys are hauling away furniture. Couches, comfy chairs, stools, pieces of this clubhouse are being cleared out.
It's still very surreal.
Martin Christensen's been volunteering at Potluck since it opened in early 2015, not long after Alaskans voted in favor of legalizing commercial cannabis. Now he's dismantling a space he helped create.
To come in and start pulling all the pictures off the wall, it's like moving out of your ex's house. You know, there's so many memories attached to everything. You want to fight over the popcorn bowl.
The venue transformed over the last 2 years. Initially, a small group of friends imagined a special event space that would be cannabis-friendly, supported by membership dues. In between events, members were allowed to come in, socialize, and consume cannabis. But as the pot industry has taken shape, Potluck became more of a commercial hub. Companies promoted product, connected with other businesses. There were even job fairs. Lee Haywood worked closely with Potluck's owners, guiding the enterprise towards a more community-oriented role.
And it was a place to normalize what cannabis was in Alaska. If you're going to open up this genre to folks, if you're going to open it up recreationally, you have to have a place for people to socialize.
The club built a dedicated following, with total membership somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 people, according to Haywood. Its relationship with city and state officials was complicated, but not totally negative. Haywood, whose background is in the military and law enforcement, says they were doing their best to operate out in the open.
We want you to come in and study us. We want you to come in and show us how we can improve, how we can work together with the state.
But that's ultimately not what happened. The beginning of the end for Potluck was in mid-April, not long before a large 420 celebration was planned. In Haywood's account, licensed cannabis companies that were partnered with Potluck for the event started reporting that state investigators viewed their participation as legally dubious. For growers or retailers, that could bring serious problems. Potluck got in touch with Alaska's Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, and what followed was a very firm letter on April 19th from the state saying the club was illegal and needed to cease operating.
It was overwhelming at that point. Yeah. You have to understand, we had our biggest event of the year, the 420 event that's going to happen, and then the day before the event, we get a letter. We read over and like, okay, what do we do now? We're in a panic. I got sound check today. I got people coming in today that are trying to get all set up. Like, okay, well now we got to pull all our sponsors. What are we going to do?
On top of this, the club's founder and owner, Teresa Collins, was dying of cancer.
And also at that time, we found out that the doctor had mentioned that Teresa probably wasn't going to make it through the night.
With all this going on, Haywood and a few others dropped their plans. They turned the April 20th event into a celebration of life for Collins.
She stayed with us through the 20th, and she passed the morning of the 21st.
Haywood says the club had always had trouble making money, and now he and others won't challenge the state in court. The Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office's case has two major claims. The first is a decision from the state's attorney general ruling that pot clubs violate a ban on public consumption. The second issue, says AMCO Director Erica McConnell, is that when voters opted for ballot measure 2, there were only 4 kinds of commercial permits that they approved.
And it did not create a license type for a social consumption location, a club. And so there is no mechanism for the Marijuana Control Board to issue a license for a business model such as potluck events.
McConnell's letter in April ends with a mention that AMCO has been working with the Anchorage Police Department on an enforcement plan, though she declined to specify what that involved. The unfortunate sequence of events, McConnell says, was coincidental. The state's timeline responding to potluck was determined by resources. Her letter also includes a note of hope that the business will redirect its efforts towards lawful operations. Haywood says that is his goal, too.
If it was going to end and we have to restructure what this looks like, now is the time to do that. This is not a surrender for us. This is a retreat for a moment to regroup and work with our lawmakers, work with the city, work with the state, and see how we can develop an on-site consumption plan that works.
The state's Marijuana Control Board is taking up 3 proposals dealing with on-site consumption at meetings in July. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Former Alaska Supreme Court Justice Dana Fabe will receive the 2017 Sandra Day O'Connor Award for the Advancement of Civics Education. The award is from the National Center for State Courts.
I was just surprised by the award, but I'm thrilled and honored, of course, particularly because it's in Sandra Day O'Connor's name, and she's one of my heroes.
Fabe supported and helped expand the Supreme Court Live program, which allows high school students throughout the state to watch oral arguments in person.
Not only are the students able to witness a real oral argument on a high school stage, but we actually teach the case to the students through the classroom in cooperation with the teachers.
Fabe also worked to establish the Alaska Supreme Court Judicial Outreach Commission and the Alaska Teaching Justice Network, which helps teachers instruct students about the role of the judiciary. Fabe says Alaska is strong in informing the public about the courts.
I think Alaska provides more information about its judges and the judicial performance of each judge, more information than any other state in the country and any other country in the world. We set the standard.
Fabe was the first woman to serve on the Alaska Supreme Court, as well as its first female Chief Justice. O'Connor was the first woman on the U.S. Supreme Court. Fabe has hosted O'Connor several times, and they've bonded over the support they received when they first joined their courts. Fabe recalls the time O'Connor brought a frozen fish she had caught.
She gave me the fish, and I told her that it was like shaking Elvis Presley's hand, that you wouldn't want to wash it. I wasn't sure I could eat the Sandra Day O'Connor fish because it was so valuable. And she said, oh, don't be silly. She's a very practical person. She said, don't be silly. Of course you'll eat the fish.
Fabe retired last year after serving on the court for 20 years. She still sits on cases as a pro tem justice. She says she enjoys being a grandmother and she has more time to play the piano and the ukulele. Fabe will receive the award in August in Philadelphia. Scientists travel into the Arctic every year to study polar bears. It helps them estimate the population. But this year, they had to cut that research short. Reporter Elizabeth Jenkins from Alaska's Energy Desk has more on how melting sea ice is making the task a lot more difficult.
Michelle St. Martin flies as far as 100 miles off the coast of the Chukchi Sea, looking for polar bear tracks or blood splatters on the ice.
Seals, ice seals are their number one prey item.
She's a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Along with her team, she sedates the polar bears before taking samples, weighing them, and removing a small tooth from each bear, a way for the scientists to determine the age of the animal. The work has been going on since 2008, when polar bears were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And since that time, St. Martin has traveled along Alaska's northwest coast to check on the bears.
So we went out this year, and in the beginning, it looked like any other year.
To get to the polar bears, her team flies from their base camp, the Red Dog Mine. But this spring, she says the biologists notice less and less sea ice. Typically, they're out there for 6 weeks. But around the time week four rolled around,
it was pretty crazy how much water just kind of showed up. And once there's water on top of the ice, it tends to melt quite a bit quicker because of the heat from the sun. And so we actually were flying the ice edge at one point out of Red Dog, and we came back the next day and flew the ice edge, and it was a loss of 15 miles.
So with no ice platform to land on, St. Martin and her colleagues were forced to cut their field season short by over a week. That's a shorter hunting season for the polar bears, too. She says knowing how many of the animals live along the Chukchi Sea is important. Scientists think the bears are doing okay, but the latest population estimate is decades old. And bears in the neighboring Beaufort Sea are showing some signs of decline.
The response of polar bears to sea ice loss differs throughout their range.
That's Todd Atwood. He heads up the polar bear research in the Beaufort Sea for the United States Geological Survey. And like St. Martin, Atwood's field research also ended weeks earlier than normal. In general, he says the Beaufort's ecosystem isn't as abundant as the Chukchi, which can make it difficult for the polar bears to find something to eat, even more so in years with less sea ice.
They're kind of showing these adverse effects more quickly.
His team is working on a follow-up to a population estimate in the Beaufort from about 7 years ago, when the polar bear numbers were down. But Atwood says this research is becoming harder to do.
We're just going to have to try and figure out ways to work around this, because I don't see it getting any better.
He's thought of a few workarounds, like earlier or shorter field seasons, to search for the polar bears before the ice melts. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The only commercial dairy in the interior will soon shut down. The owners of Northern Lights Dairy in Delta Junction, one of Alaska's two operating dairies, say they've decided to close the business they've operated since 1970 because of a lack of workers and other challenges. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Northern Lights Dairy co-owner Lois Lintelman confirmed Monday that she and her husband and co-owner Don Lintelman will shut down operations in the near future. She didn't want to talk any further about it and said they'll announce more information soon. State Agriculture Division Director Arthur Keyes said Monday he was sad to hear about the closure.
agriculture is a hard industry to be in. It's a challenge.
Keyes says the closure will leave Alaska with only the Havermeister Dairy in Palmer. UAF Experimental Farm Director Milan Shipka says he too was disappointed with the news, but he says consumers probably won't feel much impact from the closing of the only dairy in the interior.
Well, Lentilmans didn't have a huge sector of the market. I don't think it'll have a big impact on what we pay.
Shipka says the closure illustrates a more important problem, and that is Alaska's inability to feed itself, or, as some say, its lack of food security.
There's a huge concern about food security in Alaska.
Shipka says the closure of agriculture facilities like the Northern Lights Dairy illustrate the difficulty of farming in Alaska, with its cold weather, high costs, and complicated transportation logistics at the end of a long supply chain that originates in the lower 48.
We're at the end of a long chain of movement in order to get food to us.
Shipka says that chain is vulnerable to such disruptions as flooding, like that which closed the Alaska Highway in June 2012 and halted trucks delivering fresh produce, and mechanical problems that kept a barge from delivering food to the port of Anchorage in January 2016. Both disruptions delayed deliveries and left many shelves bare for several days.
The difference between the lower 48 and here is that we have one road to get here. And we have a limited number of barges that come into Anchorage. We have one port where they can unload.
Another expert, Danny Constantin with the Alaska Food Policy Council, says the state's food security problem has grown worse over the past few decades.
You know, back in 1955, Alaska produced 55% of the food that we ate. And now, in 2017, it's something like 5%.
Constantin is a board member of the council, an Anchorage-based nonprofit that's working to create a healthier and more secure food system in the state.
And that means 95% of the food that we eat is imported.
Constantin is also a former state executive director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Service Agency in Alaska, and he says despite that shortfall, there's growing interest in farming in Alaska that promises to boost the amount of food grown here.
The numbers of farms are definitely increasing in Alaska. You know, you look at the numbers of farmers' markets around the state, and they're exploding. Everywhere you go in Alaska, there's a farmers' market.
Constantin says that's probably partly due to a growing preference among consumers for locally and sustainably produced food. He concedes farmers that raise livestock for dairy or meat face greater challenges than those that simply grow veggies and fruit, but he says the grow-your-own trend in Alaska will help us feed ourselves in the years ahead. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Summer in Alaska is full of endless daylight, a few mosquitoes, and also some pretty amazing or terrible weather, depending on the year. So, how are forecasters sizing up the long-term outlook for June, July, and August? For an answer to that question, we turned to Brian Brettschneider from our segment, Ask a Climatologist. He told Annie Feit it looks like it will be warmer than normal for most of the state.
You know, if you look at the long-range outlooks put out by NOAA or the long-range outlooks put out by computer ensembles, everything in Alaska is looking warm. I mean, really everything everywhere is looking warm, includes Alaska.
And is it just a little bit warm or a lot warm?
Well, they don't really project what the temperatures will be, but what they do is they project the likelihood of being above normal. So we're not in the highest category, but we're in a strong category of higher probabilities of having above normal temperatures. Now, that being said, we're starting off at a warm baseline. Globally, the temperature is higher than normal. And so without factoring anything else into consideration, because we're already starting at a high baseline, we're already starting off in the above normal category. So that's our starting point. So, you know, if it ends up being cloudier and wetter than normal, then that might push us back down in the normal category. But if it's sunnier and higher pressure, that might really shoot us up into way above normal.
And what about rain?
Rain and precipitation is always much more difficult to project months in advance. So the signals are quite a bit weaker than they are for temperatures. That being said, all of Alaska is currently painted in the normal to maybe a slight increase in probability of above normal precipitation. So it's again, that's not something really to hang a hat on, but that's what the outlook is showing at the moment.
How accurate have these long-term outlooks gotten?
Well, they're better for sure. And for temperatures, they're pretty good. Sometimes there are misses, but for temperatures, they do pretty good for these seasonal outlooks. Precipitation, not so much. They're not bad, but just this climate signals are not very strong for precipitation, you know, more than a few weeks in advance.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Miss Alaska was one of the top 10 contestants in the Miss USA pageant, but Alyssa London was eliminated before the contest's final round. KTOO's Quentin Chandler reports.
New Jersey. We love you, Alyssa!
Alyssa London, the first Tlingit Miss Alaska, was just eliminated in the Miss USA competition in Las Vegas. A few more than a dozen of her fans came to a watch party in Juneau to show their support. London made it to the semifinals and was one of the top 10 contestants for the crown. Yolanda Fulmer says that is exciting.
I think this also shows other young women, you know, in our community as Alaska Natives or Native American women, that their dreams are important, that they should go for them, and that they can accomplish, you know, their dreams and dream big.
Fulmer says it's disappointing that London didn't win, but she's proud of what she has accomplished. London graduated from Stanford University, where she wrote an honors thesis on economic development in Southeast Alaska. She's the cultural ambassador of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and she built a business that sells products influenced by Southeast Alaska Native culture. When a Miss USA host asked London what she wanted people to know about Alaska, she singled out Native culture.
I want them to know that we have amazing, unique cultures in our state. There are 229 different tribes. Tonight you will see me wearing a traditional Tlingit robe over my evening gown, emulating our dance robes. It will have a killer whale crest on it, and I'm very proud of my culture.
After London's loss, the watch party crowd recorded a video message to show her their support.
We are proud of you! We are proud of you! Alyssa London!
Outside of the party, Tommy Gamble says he is a friend of London's and that this loss is not the end for her.
The whole entire journey was the experience that she wanted, and she's going to learn from it and probably even come out even on top. And you can crown a winner for the contest, but because of her name and her culture and everything that she's supported and is going to continue to support, she'll always be one of our queens. And so I'm really proud of her.
The watch party was organized by Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Rasha McChesney, Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, and Casey Grove, Zachariah Hughes, and Annie Feit in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Sean Dugan's our editor and producer, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a fantastic evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.